Indeed. Back here with Pat Halloran. We're talking a little bit about the U2. Just before the break, you had been selected for the program, and you saw the airplane for the very first time, and you probably had some questions in your mind about exactly what it was you got yourself into.
Yeah, it was very strange. You know, we didn't really know the mission or anything else yet. And then there was no two-seat trainer, for example, so your first flight was solo. And it's such a different airplane. It flies different than anything, I think, any airplane I've ever seen. And the thing that first got our attention when we looked in the cockpit, that it has a yoke instead of a stick. Now, we're all fighter pilots and used to a stick and throttle. And so we all looked at that with great dismay that we'd have to fly with a yoke. And as it turned out, that was the only way, the only thing that would fit in the cockpit. There wasn't room for a stick, if you can imagine that. And probably the worst part about transitioning is we had to get used to that early model spacesuit, and it was absolutely terrible. So very, very uncomfortable, and you'd have black and blue welts all over your body when you'd come down from a mission, and you had to pre-breathe 100% oxygen for 2 hours before it even got in the cockpit before takeoff. And the suit was very claustrophobic, too. And if you had any tendency to get claustrophobia, boy, that was going to trigger it off once they snapped you inside that thing. Because technically, you're not supposed to ever get out of it by yourself. And so once you're locked in, you've got that trapped feeling. And then the cockpit was very tiny. So in addition to the suit, then when they close the canopy, now you're really in a phone booth. And then long missions, we had 10 hours worth of gas, so... it was a mental adjustment to fly the airplane. You really had to psych yourself up to say, I'm really having a good time.
Were there pilots who were not able to deal with the spacesuit, the cramped conditions?
Yeah. There were several pilots that just said, this isn't for me. I can't handle that suit. And I think most of us at one point or another would get claustrophobia. Usually you'd get it while you're going through that pre-breathing period. Because you're just sitting there with nothing to do, and you're sucking oxygen, you're zipped up in that tight suit, and it's like people who are learning how to scuba dive. You're convinced you're not getting enough air, and you start to hyperventilate, and that sets it off.
So your first solo in the U2 is your first flight in the U2.
Oh yeah. that was exciting.
No simulators in those days.
No simulator.
Because it flies so differently than any other airplane, what were your thoughts as you lined up on the end of the runway on that first takeoff?
Well, the good thing about it is it takes off in a very short roll because it's very lightweight with a relatively powerful engine. So you didn't have to worry about it too long. Once you added the throttle, you were on your way, and you were out of control at that point. But the first flight, and maybe the first couple of flights, I don't remember, we didn't wear the pressure suit. We just wore regular flying equipment. So you felt a little more comfortable in the airplane. And you just took it up by yourself to, 20,000 feet or something, and flew around for a while and practiced some slow flight and that sort of thing. And then basically you came in and the bulk of the training was learning how to land the airplane, which was quite difficult because of the landing gear configuration, the bicycle gear.
Yeah, I've seen some videos on the internet of some very interesting landings of the U2. None of those are yours, right?
No, those are mine. No, they videoed all the, or in those days, just camered all the landings for training purposes. And there are some hellacious landing things. They put them all together in one video, and they're just hilarious. And the airplane would go off the runway frequently, but it seldom ever caused any damage because you're very low airspeed. Now, when you're on a landing roll, if you lose control, you're probably only going 40 miles an hour, and it'll go off in the mud somewhere, and they haul it back, wash it down, and send it back up.
Just like a big Piper cub, right?
Yeah.
Was there a typical mission or a mission profile that you'd use in the U2?
Well, the training missions were a combination of training to take pictures and training to navigate. And some of those navigation procedures were based on celestial navigation. There was a sextant in the nose of the airplane. And so we were trained to do celestial navigation, which in a one-man airplane is extremely difficult. And there's not much space, and you got to have a pair of dividers and pencils and maps, and you're plotting all that stuff, and plus shooting the stars. So that was a very cumbersome and not too accurate system to navigate. But we had to train and learn how to do that, because we'd use that over the ocean when there's nothing visual to check, and at night flying we'd of course do celestial. And some of the missions that we went up at very high northern latitudes, even up to the North Pole, your compasses are no good up there, so we would use celestial heading checks to determine the heading of the airplane. Because, you know, when you leave the North Pole, all you got is south. And so celestial would pay off in times like that. And the rest of the time, we would be practicing following a route structure on a map. And, you know, having simulated targets, we'd have to overfly exactly in order to take pictures and things. And that was the most demanding part of the whole thing, was to learn how to do that, you know, stay exactly on course. And one of the things that helped that, of course, is that above 60,000 feet, we were flying about 70. Flying about above 60, there's really no wind. Very seldom is there any wind up there. So dead reckoning was quite accurate. Now, you couldn't base that on your camera coverage required, but you'd always be in the ballpark, and then you could fine-tune by looking visually through a drift sight that we had in the airplane. Find your target and fly directly over it.
Well, it's amazing that when you think about those missions, especially with today's technology, GPS, obviously the Soviets didn't have VORs for you to follow or any other kind of navigational aids that you'd be able to use. So,
well, they had radio stations, commercial radio stations, and the only thing the airplane had in it was an ADF.
Okay.
You know, we could tune in music and radio, commercial radio stations. So the agency guys that flew over the Soviet Union, they could tune in commercial, they had all the frequencies. They could tune in commercial stations on the various towns to get where they wanted to go. So in that sense, it did pay off.
So you're flying in the U-2 for several years. You're flying the missions. Then you make the jump to the SR-71. I mean, that's it's rather unusual, isn't it, in the Air Force to be trained in one airplane and then move to another one?
Well, I spent 9 years in the U-2, so it was about time they got rid of me to do something. But when the SR-71 or the Blackbirds were built, again, the Strategic Air Command was going to be running the SR-71 program, and so to draw crew members to fly that airplane, since it was, you know, quite different also, they picked, I think it was 6 crews out of the B-58 supersonic bomber, the Hustler, and they picked 9 crews from the U-2 program. Now, we were used to pressure suits, and we're used to high altitude, and used to reconnaissance. And the 58 guys were used to a big, powerful supersonic airplane with one pilot. So we all became very good friends, and the transition and blending of the two crew forces together went very smoothly. We all appreciated what the other guy was bringing to the table. And so when that program started, like I say, they picked 9 of us. I was the senior one at that time, so I was the first one to check out in the Blackbird.
So the first one to check out, but there was, this time, did you have someone with you, or was this another solo experience?
Oh, no, this time we had a two-seat pilot trainer. In fact, the first airplane that was delivered to the Air Force in January of 66 was a two-place pilot trainer, so we could immediately get into training. But the SR was a more conventional airplane in the sense of it had 3 wheels and had a stick, and, you know, it flew like a real airplane versus the U-2. So you could have transitioned quite easily without the trainer. But they needed the trainer for the high altitude supersonic, because that gets a little dicey up there. And so you wouldn't want to send everybody in the program up there solo for the first time. It's best to have the trainer.
If I remember correctly, the SR-71 also is sort of a leaky airplane on the ground. I remember the one that was here at Oshkosh a number of years ago, but changes when it gets up into the air. Just want to explain what happens to the airplane?
Yeah, the airplane does leak on the ground. It drips. You know, there's some of the TV programs, they talk about how they lead you to believe the fuel just pours out of it, and we have to have a tanker right after takeoff, or we're going to flame. All sorts of crazy stories that are not true. It just drips, and the airplane grows about 6 to 8 inches in flight when it heats up, and of course then it doesn't leak anymore. And Kelly Johnson, for years and years, tried to find a sealant that would accommodate the growth and still retain the ceiling on the ground. he finally just, I guess, said to hell with it and let it leak. And they monitored all those leaks. The maintenance guys had a log for each airplane, and they would actually go out and count the drips and the locations. It would mark it on their sheet. And when it got really extreme, they would have to send the airplane back to the factory to be resealed. But it was no problem once you took off and got in the air. Everything tightened up, and there's no more leakage.
Now, the SR-71 had a pretty long career with the Air Force. They were retired and then unretired, but it was an amazing airplane all the way around.
Yeah, it really was. It was so far ahead of its day, and you know, Kelly Johnson designed that without the benefit of computers. That was a stubby pencil slide rule designed airplane, and of course it exceeded anything, and it still is the fastest, highest flying operational airplane in the world that's ever been built. And I doubt if there'll ever be another operational airplane. There may be test vehicles or rocket ships, you know, things like that, but an air breathing jet engine airplane, it was the ultimate, and there will probably never be one with better performance.
Of course, I'm sure you can't do an interview without this question being asked. Exactly how high did you fly?
How high did I go? I got to shoot you, you know, if I say that. That's the obvious answer, right?
That's right.
Yeah. No, you know, all the performance characteristics of the airplane are declassified now. Yeah. Kelly Johnson designed it for 80,000 feet in Mach 3.2. That was his target, and that was reached and exceeded. But the real limiting speed was not the airframe, it was the engine, the temperature on the engine, 427 degrees centigrade on the compressor face, and we had a big gauge that showed that, and Pratt and Whitney said that beyond 427, the warranty expires. So that was the ultimate thing, but at Mach 3.2, almost always you were below that limit. Depending on the atmosphere and the temperatures up there. Occasionally they'd get to a point where they had to stop at a different airspeed. And as far as the maximum altitude, I don't think anybody, you know, the test pilots at Lockheed would have gotten the most altitude. They've had it over 90,000 feet, one of the Blackbirds, and they've gone beyond 3.2 to maybe 3.4 or something. But the high speeds generate tremendous temperature rises. It's just the temperature curve goes way up beyond about 2.8. And so that was one reason Kelly said 3.2 is fast enough, which it was. He said beyond that, you're going to cause damage to other systems. They're going to fail, you know, electrical or hydraulics or fuel pumps or whatever, because they were subjected to temperatures that no airplane has ever experienced. And that's why the airplane was made out of titanium. No normal aluminum combinations could accommodate those temperatures.
Well, good. We're talking with Major General Pat Halloran, and we'll take a break here for just a moment. We are at the Welcome Center, the EAA Welcome Center. This is EAA Radio.